Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to this event, Animal Economics. It is really my pleasure to introduce this event. My name is Marion Dumas. I'm an associate professorial research fellow at the Grantham Research Institute for Climate Change and the Environment here at LSE, co-organizing this event with Jonathan Birch from the Department of Philosophy and the director of the Jeremy Kohler Center for Animal Sentience. The event is also co-hosted by the Global School of Sustainability. Sustainability has now permeated every branch of the school, so we're all working together, which is great. So this event will consist of a lecture by Professor Nicolas Treisch first, followed by a panel discussion with Professor Jonathan Birch, Professor Richard Bennett, and Dr. Ganga Sridhar. It will be followed by 30-minute Q&A, both with the online and in-person audience. So just as a reminder, we have fire exit points at the top of the room. And if you could keep your cell phone on silent mode, that would be appreciated. We are recording the event, and in all likelihood, it will be available in a few days as a podcast. So it is now my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Professor Nicolas Treisch, who is a decision and welfare theorist based at the Toulouse School of Economics. So today, Professor Treisch is going to present his new book, Animal Economics, which is the culmination of 10 years of an intensive foray into the topic of animal welfare from the point of view of an economist. Now, it is really common to say that a new book is groundbreaking, and so it would sound probably trite if I tell you that it is. But in my mind, there is no doubt that this book is groundbreaking. And the reason is that no economist has so far touched this topic with any seriousness. And here, Professor Treisch is developing a non-anthropocentric approach to valuing the welfare of non-human species. So in doing so, he's paying close attention to the lived experiences of animals and finds convincing solutions to extremely thorny problems of how to assess welfare and how to compare welfare in an interspecies context, contrasting that of humans and pigs and cows and chicken and fish. So the payoff from this move is large, as you're going to discover. It becomes possible to analyze our decisions in light of the welfare of animals, to reason about the trade-offs between human and non-human welfare, and to think of economic policy to reduce the truly stupendous scale of animal suffering in intensive agricultural systems. So I think this is a serious intellectual leap forward, which can help us become a more sensitive species. So we'll also introduce the speakers of our panel. We have Dr. Ganga Sridhar, who is an assistant professor of behavioral science in the Department of Psychological and Behavioral Science here at LSE, who does both behavioral and experimental economics work studying how to change human behavior in ways that benefit people and the planet. So she examines, for example, dilemmas such as how people apprehend dilemmas such as mass extinction, climate change, and the sort of how that translates then into motivations in consumers and citizens to change behavior. Richard Bennett is a professor of agricultural economics at the University of Reading. His research focuses very much on the economics of animal health and welfare. He's very close to policy. He has served on various government committees, including 10 years on the Farm Animal Welfare Committee. He is currently part of the government's Animal Sentience Committee and a trustee for two animal welfare charities, the University's Federation for Animal Welfare and the Humane Slaughter Association. Finally, Jonathan Birch is a professor of philosophy and director of the Jeremy Kohler Center for Animal Sentience within LSE's Department of Philosophy. And his research focuses on animal sentience, cognition, and welfare, and the evolution of altruism and social behavior. He has recently published a book called The Edge of Sentience, Risk and Precaution in Humans, Other Animals, and AI, which engages the debate over the nature of sentience and the criteria for attributing it to non-human animals. So we will then have a Q&A. I will ask you to state your questions succinctly, refrain from the temptation to deliver a long series of remarks, and the online audience can write down questions in the chat, and we will select a few of them. Thank you very much. Enjoy the evening.
Thank you, Marion. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm very glad to be here, to have this opportunity to talk about my book tonight. Thank you also to the panel. As you understand very soon, there are different topics in the book, and I think I'm lucky enough to have a wonderful panel that have different expertise that can address these various topics. So I'm not going to present, to make a very long presentation, because I think it's very nice and actually more fun to have an exchange. And so I hope in about 20, 25 minutes, I will be done presenting. It's a sort of very brief overview of a book. So Animal Economics, it's an academic book, even though I believe most of the book is accessible to a broad audience. There are just some parts which are a bit technical. It's the language of economics, but most of the other parts are really, I think, accessible to everyone. And even the technical parts, I spend some time to really explain what I'm doing there. So in this, I would say that there are two main objectives of this book. The first objective is to integrate animals into economics. There are a few exceptions, but in general, we completely ignore animals in economics. We don't talk about them. We don't study them. They are not part of our studies. There are a few fields, agricultural economics, environmental economics, in which we sometimes talk about animals. But in general, we talk about them in a very specific way. Animals typically are commodities. They are resources. They are biodiversity. They are food. So in a sense, we tend to forget what is really essential, I would say, about animals, the fact that they can experience welfare. They are sentient. There is a major difference between a carrot and a pig. The pig can feel. And this is, in general, in economics, we tend to forget this aspect. So with this book, I want to integrate animals and their welfare into economics. And the other objective is to integrate economics in the debates we have about animal welfare. So these are the two main objectives with this book. When you have seen this title, Animal Economics, you may have thought maybe that it's a bit strange, original, maybe a niche topic, and if that's the case, you're completely right. It's really new, I believe, or very fairly new. And so we may wonder first, why animals, why economics, and why both? What do we get if we combine animal and economics? So let me try to explain a little bit more what I'm doing in the book. First, it's important to realize that animals still play a significant role in our economies. They provide us with food. They provide us with clothing. They are around us. But the point is that very often we don't even see them. We don't even think about them. And of course, they are everywhere in this world. Okay. And once again, one key aspect here is that they can experience welfare. That's very important for an economist. Because in economics, we are obsessed with welfare. Well, we reflect on welfare to think about individual decisions. We tend to assume that people choose decisions to maximize their individual welfare with some adaptation. And we also reflect on collective welfare to think about our policies. So we are talking all the time about welfare in economics. But the key point here, again, is that we only talk about the welfare of humans, not the welfare of the other animals. And that's, of course, a big limitation. It's morally problematic if we listen to the philosophers. Okay? And so I believe that it's time to go further and, I would say, enlarge the moral scope and include animals into our studies in economics. There are other disciplines, of course, that have discussed that, in particular philosophy, you have a specific field, animal ethics. In law also, you have a specific field, animal law, animal right law, but it's not the case in economics. And one of my dreams, I would say, is that I contribute with this book to create and develop a new field, animal economics or animal welfare economics, with others. And maybe I hope that someday we'll have in some classes in environmental economics a specific chapter about animals, for instance, or in public economics. So what can economics do regarding animals and their welfare? First, I think they can, and economics can explain the markets where animals are involved. They can explain the use and treatment of animals. And we have already a bunch of research, in particular in agricultural economics, where people study the use of animals, the health of animals, the welfare of animals, and Richard is one of the leaders of this literature in agricultural economics. We can also work at the intersection of economics and philosophy to think about moral issues, normative issues. In economics, we talk a lot about the social welfare function, our social objective, and reflect how we can integrate animals into our social objective. And this is some work that we can typically develop with philosophers, such as Jonathan, who has worked a lot on several relevant concepts for us economists, and in particular in his recent book about sentience. We can also, and we have actually also to think about psychology and sociology, because as soon as we want to integrate animals economics, we have to understand the way people perceive and think about animals. And actually, we know very little about that. In economics, we have a long-standing literature about willingness to pay. It's very useful, very informative, but it's a bit narrow as an approach. We would like to develop studies about pro-animal concerns, very much the same as we have plenty of studies about pro-social concerns or pro-environmental concerns. And as I will show a bit later, there are plenty of puzzles. It turns out that we like some animals, we ignore, we don't like others. It depends on the situation. And we are struggling as researchers to really understand people's behavior. And so this is why we need to work here with people experts in psychology, such as Ganga. And finally, one key aspect is the institutional context, the politics. Politics, in particular for farmed animals, is central. And we need to better understand the politics of the decision that involve animals. There is a major gap here. If we look at the opinion polls, at survey studies, even at experimental studies, we can be very confident that people care a lot about animals. They tell this in opinion polls. They want to ban intensive farming. Sometimes they even pay in the lab to buy products which are like free range and not coming from intensive farming. So it seems that people care a lot about animals, but it's not at all what we see in terms of political decision. How could it be? How could it be that most people seem to care about animals? We want to ban animal farming, intensive farming, sorry, and we don't see much in political decisions. There is a huge gap in politics, and we want to understand that. And I think Marion, who is the chair today, can contribute also to in the discussion, I hope later, to think about that. She is an expert on several things, but in particular the political aspect and institutions. So this is the book, Animal Economics. The key word here is welfare. Okay, this is through welfare that animals are integrated into economics, but the subtitle is very important, directly and indirectly accounting for animal welfare. So why directly and indirectly? Let me explain. The book has essentially two parts. I mean, there is a long preliminary part, introduction, but then there are two parts, direct approach and indirect approach. And these correspond to the two ways we may have to integrate the welfare of animals, the direct approach and the indirect approach. The direct approach is non-anthropocentric. It means that animals matter intrinsically. Okay? So animals are directly included in the social objective, in the social welfare functions. This means that if we protect a whale, if we improve the welfare of a pig, it's good for the whale, it's good for the pig. And this is the welfare of these animals that we want to integrate. This seems obvious when we say this, but this, we never do that, essentially, in economics. Because we are always anthropocentric, so we care about the welfare of animals through humans, not directly, not the welfare of animals themselves. It's very difficult to do that. And in the book, I collect recent research of different teams in the world that have tried to advance on this front, non-anthropocentric approach. And once again, this is very new in economics. We are always anthropocentric, essentially. So if we are non-anthropocentric, if animals matter intrinsically, then that means that if we humans affect animals, then we generate an externality on animals because their welfare matters. And then we can build on the long-standing literature in economics about the management of externality. This is exactly what I'm doing. I'm just presenting the standard literature in economics and in environmental economics, for instance, Pigouvian taxation, and just reinterpreting some standard results. But there is more, because there are challenges, new challenges. We don't know what is a multi-species social welfare function. There is a difficult problem of population ethics that I don't have time to discuss now, but I'm happy to discuss if there are questions. And there is also the practicalities. How can we estimate directly animal welfare? We cannot use human willingness to pay because we are non-anthropocentric. So how can we estimate animal welfare in a way that can be useful, for instance, for policy making, for benefit cost analysis? Question mark. So that's for the direct approach. But there, in the second part of the book, there is the indirect approach, the more standard approach, as we do in economics. It's the anthropocentric approach. Animals matter through humans. Okay, so we care about the whale because humans care about the whale. Okay, so we are going to value the increase in welfare of a pig because some humans at least care about this improvement in welfare. So we go through humans, and so here we get into behavioral economics because we have to understand these preferences of humans towards animals, okay, such as altruism. But are we really, really altruistic? Is it something else? We don't know much about that. So in the book, I make a lot of assumptions and I emphasize what we know and what we don't know. And there is a lot that we don't know. I will present a few puzzles. One issue is public good, which is standard. So here again, I'm presenting what we know in the literature from public goods, but with this application of animal welfare. And also, I emphasize the behavioral aspects, what we know as a summary from the literature in psychology and literature in economics, in particular the willingness to pay literature. There are various challenges, and the main challenge, again, is to understand the psychologies of consumers, of citizens, toward animals. So, in the remaining of my talk, last, let's say, 10 minutes, I'm going to present you some sketch or example of what I do in the direct part approach and in the indirect part approach, okay? And so, first I'm going to talk about the direct approach. So here, we remember that one of the challenges is to obtain a method to value animal welfare directly, not through humans. How can we do that? So, at the end of this part, I build on some existing studies, in particular the work by Budolfsson and Spears, who propose such a method. The idea is to break the problem into different pieces. First, to say, okay, we can try to have an animal welfare score, meaning scoring from a common scale for all animals, let's say from 0 to 1. 1 is maximal welfare, 0 is welfare equivalent to death or non-existence, and below 0 is life not worth living. Okay, so we can try to construct such a score, very much like the quality index for those who are working in health economics for humans. We may want to construct such a score, and I show how we can do that, or at least start doing that, using some existing frameworks, 5 domains, 5 freedoms in animal welfare science. So now we have a score. So this, if we have a pig at 0.6, for instance, it means that the pig has twice the welfare of another pig who is at 0.3. But this does not tell anything about comparing the welfare of a pig at 0.3 compared to the welfare of a frog at 0.3. That we don't know. So we need something else. And so the idea is to have another parameter, utility potential. Of course, it's extremely brave to do that. It's very challenging. And I'm not claiming it's this is necessarily the good approach. It's one approach that we can propose as a starting point, let's say, that I hope will be improved in the future. And so the idea is to have this sort of conversion factor that can translate into social welfare the score of a pig at 0.3 and the score of a frog at 0.3. To do that, one method, among a few other methods, is to use the number of forebrain neurons. The idea is that it's a proxy for the capacity for welfare. It's not a very good proxy, but it's one proxy. We may criticize it. Once again, I hope we are going to improve this proxy in the future. But this is one proxy. The idea is that the pig has more forebrain neurons than a frog, and so it can experience potentially more welfare than a frog, and so this will be translated in more social welfare. And at the end, we want to aggregate that, and we need to plug a social welfare function. So that's the basic idea. Sorry, I cannot get into the detail, but I'm going to show you an application of this method just to give you an idea of what you get. Let me emphasize again that this is extremely tentative. It's based on many assumptions, heroic assumptions, so I'm not claiming that we should trust these numbers. So here you have 4 categories of meats and animals raised in France, and we took the most standard type of rearing conditions. We have chicken, pork, cow meat, dairy cows, and then cows from beef herds. Okay. In gray, so it's the retail price and the pricing of externalities, as we commonly do in economics. In gray, you have the retail price of per kilo of these different types of meats. You see that beef, cow meat is more expensive. In red, blue, and green, you have the environmental externalities, which are priced. We took that from other studies. So it's the air pollution externality, water externality, and greenhouse gases emission externality. Okay. You see that this increases the gap because there are more externalities for cow meat. Okay? So it increases the gap between the price of cow meat and the price of chicken meat, for instance, per kilo, if we account for this environmental externality. And now let's integrate the novelty, the externality in terms of animal welfare. This is the yellow part here. This is what we've done with Romain Spinoza. We just published the paper very recently. And we make here very conservative assumption, and nevertheless, you can see on the figure that it's very significant. It dominates the analysis. We have here a tax per kilo of chicken of about 40 euros. So basically, it means that we should ban. Nobody will buy, can afford a chicken at this price. So basically, it means that this tax will lead to a ban of intensive farming. Okay. Observe here an interesting aspect. There is a negative correlation between the environmental externalities and animal welfare externalities. Okay. So we, meaning that we even propose a subsidy for cow meat, okay? It's a negative tax. But we have very high tax on for chicken and pork, which generate much less environmental externalities than cow. Okay, so we have this negative externality, so which completely change the picture if we think in terms of taxing meats. I have two remaining slides, and now let me jump to the indirect approach. And I'm going to present you two paradoxes that we struggle to explain and that I develop in the book. One is the vote by gap. It's based on an example, a real example. In 2008, in California, more than 90% of the eggs that were sold in California were coming from cage hens. Okay, that means that Californians were buying eggs from hens in battery cages, essentially. Even though they had the possibility on the market to buy a different type of eggs, for instance, cage-free eggs or organic eggs. Okay? But so if we look at this market data, they suggest that people, Californians, don't care too much about animal welfare. They go for the cheapest, low welfare eggs. Okay? But the same year, there was a referendum. There are many referendums in California, and there was a referendum about animal welfare. It was called Proposition 2. 63% of California voters voted in favor of Proposition 2, which is about banning the cages. Okay? So why is that? Why when people go on the supermarket, they don't seem to care about animal welfare, and when they go voting, they tell us that they care about animal welfare, so that they want that we ban cages for hens. One possible explanation is a public good effect. This idea that through voting we can basically have more collective impact. Okay, while in the supermarket it's a very small trivial impact. Okay, so that's one possibility, but there is one study suggesting that it's not the end of the story. There might be other explanation. And one explanation could be salience, visibility. Why is that? Because the context of decision making is very different. If you go voting, you see information. You have a simple decision. Do I want to vote in favor or against cages? And you will see images. You will see something clear about animal cruelty. Who is going to really vote in favor of the cages? Okay, it's salient. The animal welfare issue and the suffering of animals. While in the supermarket, it's very different. People may think about something else. They are in a routine mode. They look at the prices. They look at the quality of meat. Many of them probably don't even think about animals. Okay? So the visibility of animals, the salience of animal suffering is very different. And this may, I'm saying may because I don't know any study about that, this may explain what's going on. Last slide, another paradox that we struggle to explain and that was research in psychology and now there are a few studies in economics about this paradox. Yeah, let me add that in this presentation I focus on farmed animals and meat. And this is because this is my main focus in the book, even though I have some chapters and sections about wild animals and pets. But for the presentation, I'm focusing on farmed animals and meat. So what is the meat paradox? It's about cognitive dissonance. This idea that we may have sometimes a tension between two cognitions or two facts, two actions, and we are not comfortable with that. For instance, it could be I care about animals and I enjoy eating meat. Maybe we are not very comfortable with that. Could be inconsistent. Okay? This may create a psychological tension, a cognitive dissonance, a psychological cost, as we would say in economics. And the theory of cognitive dissonance in psychology tells us that there are essentially two strategies to minimize this cost. One is to change behavior. I could, for instance, reduce meat consumption. I become flexitarian, vegetarian, vegan. I could also better select the meat I buy. Okay? I change my behavior. If I'm if I feel this psychological tension, to reduce this tension. But there is another strategy, which is the core of cognitive dissonance, which is about adjusting beliefs. This is much more subtle. It's maybe probably unconscious, okay? We look away. We don't think too much about intensive farming. We focus on some cows outside, okay? So we adjust the way we think about animals to feel better, to feel less guilty, okay? One example of this study in the literature in psychology is on the bottom right here by Bastian and co-authors. They ask questions to students about the edibility of animals and the mind of animals, the level of intelligence. So it's about the perception of students. And what they found is that, in general, people attribute less intelligence to farm animals compared to pets and wild animals. But why is that? Even in terms of level of intelligence of dog and cow, or pigs, it's not clear that the cows and pigs are less intelligent. Okay? So one possible explanation is the meat paradox. We want to believe that farmed animals are less intelligent because we feel less guilty when we eat them. And to finish, let me mention a few implications of this meat paradox and those that has been studied in economics and that I present in the book. One is information avoidance, like on the top right figure. We don't want to know. There is evidence about that. Another is the fact that there is a correlation between the level of meat consumption and the beliefs. In particular, there is lower realism among high meat consumers. Another is some paradoxical result, potentially. This is a theory result, that empathy, compassion may have paradoxical effects. Why is that? Because for those who have a lot of empathy, a lot of compassion for animals, indeed for fixed beliefs, they may eat less meat, for instance, they may donate more to philanthropic associations, but there is a beliefs effect. If you are very sensitive to animals, you are going to be even more motivated to ignore what's going on, to have rosy beliefs about what's going on in the farming industry. And that may lead to paradoxical effects. And it may explain, that will be my final word, also vegetarian epiphanies. This is a strange phenomenon. There is a lot of evidence that people become vegetarian from one day to the other. And this is strange because we know that food habits are very resilient. When we observe people, even people who have changed country, for instance, they change a lot, but one thing they tend to keep is their food habits. So it's very strange when we see people from one day to the other changing their consumption habit, food habit, in such a spectacular way, not eating meat anymore. How can we explain that? And maybe this is because of a meat paradox. If we live in a world where we don't want to think about animals, when we avoid information, we repress even signals, then it may be that our beliefs are very far from the truth. But in some cases, it could be that some people read a book, see a video, an image, and this may have a drastic impact because it may lead them to completely change their belief and in turn adjust their action. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thanks very much, Nicholas. And please come and join us over here at the panel. I'm Professor Jonathan Birch. I'm a professor of philosophy here at the LSE. I'm also director of the Jeremy Collis Center for Animal Sentience, and I'll be chairing this panel discussion component of the evening. Really pleased you've written this book, Nicholas. I mean, I've been at the LSE for almost 12 years now, and when I founded the Center for Animal Sentience here last September, ever since then, I've found people have been coming up to me and saying, I didn't know the LSE did anything to do with animals. I thought it was all about economics. And I find that a frustrating thought. It's a thought that I'm battling against. Because as I see it, one of the huge contributions the LSE has made, one of the ideas that it is most closely associated with, is that economics is not just about money. Economics is also about well-being. And I think that's absolutely right. But I think economics does not just have to be about the well-being of one of the Earth species, ignoring all of the rest of sentient life on the planet. I think economics can very naturally be the study of the well-being of the rest of sentient life too. And I'm so pleased that there's now a book I can point people towards that says, look, you can put animals and economics together into animal economics. It's fantastic that that exists, and I'd encourage everyone to go and buy a copy of it at the end of the event. But we want to also think critically about the book. I'm really pleased to be joined by two panelists who are going to help us do that. I think two panelists who are totally on board with the general thrust of it, the general thrust of trying to bring animals into economics, but maybe have some different perspectives on the best way to do that. Ganga Sridhar, a behavioral economist from here at the LSE, and Richard Bennett, an agricultural economist from University of Reading, who's also on the UK government's Animal Sentience Committee. And both really well placed, I think, to think about the practicality of some of the proposals in the book, but also about the ethical foundations of the proposals in the book. And it'd be great if we can talk about both of those sets of issues. I mean, let's start with practicality. And Richard, you're very much at the coalface of government policy in your work on the Animal Sentience Committee. When you read Nicholas's book, do you feel as though what he's proposing is practical, or do you have concerns about that?
Thanks, Jonathan. First of all, I'd like to say how much I enjoyed reading this book and how welcome this book is. And we shouldn't underestimate, you know, what a task it sets itself, and that Nicholas has set himself, you know, to give animals greater moral consideration by developing a multi-species social welfare function. That's quite something. You know, I've been an economist for longer than I'd like to admit to. And it you know, economics as a discipline, we know, is all about human welfare. Animal welfare only has any consideration if as Nicholas said, it matters to us as people. So having this idea where, you know, animals matter and animal welfare matters in its own right, regardless of whether we care about, as individuals, whether we care about animals or not, is a big deal. And I think Nicholas beautifully takes the reader. It's a great read. I've enjoyed reading it enormously. And Nicholas beautifully takes the reader through this analytical argument of how it might be done. But he's very self-critical as well, very reflective, and he doesn't ignore other perspectives. He mentions these throughout the book. So it's not just Nicholas's vision. He takes into account other perspectives and so on, which I just thought was great. So yeah, I'm an applied economist, and in particular I'm very interested in using economic theory to help inform policy, to inform policymakers and policy teams to help them. And so always in the back of my mind, from the very start of reading the book, I was wondering, you know, how far can we take this? And can we actually end up with some sort of tool, or at least some sort of guidance that would enable ministers and policy teams, you know, to make better public policy decisions in relation to how we relate to animals. And so, Nicholas, I just wonder, you know, to what extent do you think this could be developed into something that would have some real practical value, both in terms of informing people about animals, all of us, and the importance of animals, but also, you know, that sort of policy decision making, whether this way of thinking could have a real influence on policy decision making, because that's when it will have a real impact on the lives of animals and on the way we use animals.
Yes, I agree with all what you said, and I'm very thankful for
for what you have done in your career to try to bring this topic to the, at the policy-making level. It's very challenging. We have to take into account many constraints, political constraints, typically. And it's actually very difficult and very often not very rewarding because we don't get publication, very high publication with that, and very often we are very disappointed with what we get in terms of our impact on political decision making. And I think it's indeed an issue with this book, in particular with a direct approach, the non-anthropocentric approach. I mentioned that briefly in the book. I use that term, a fundamental political objection, because there is a fundamental political objection with this approach, which is the following. The fact that at the end of the day, we humans have political power. We make decisions for humans. And the non-anthropocentric approach is saying something very different. It's saying, in the social objective, we care about the welfare of humans and the welfare of animals. But who is going to represent these animals in political decision-making? No one. And if there is someone representing animals, it has to go through humans. So it has to go through the second approach. And so we end up with this sort of paradox that is very challenging. But there is some hope, because there has been historically over situations where, think about slavery, for instance, where like people don't, of course it's very different, but people didn't have political voice, but we evolved a moral belief had an impact, and potentially at some point, I'm not completely hopeless. People may use that research and the research by Jonathan and others in philosophy, and this may change the moral belief of humans, of those who are in power. But you raise a very challenging question, and indeed it's one of the next stage. How can we make this operational, practical, and implemented at the political level?
I mean, Ganga, it'd be good to bring you in on the question of the practicality of the proposed framework in both parts of the book. I mean, as a behavioral economist, I know you're particularly interested in this vote by gap issue.
Yeah, I think the vote by gap issue is really, I guess we put on different hats, right, as citizens, as consumers. So one, I guess, is what identity is activated when you take these decisions. And in that sense, what relationship you have to these, I mean, sentient beings, I think is really interesting and could be unpacked. And that's what brings me to another point when we think about relationships. I understand, and I totally also enjoyed reading the book a lot. It was very stimulating, and it was something I wish I had when I was a PhD student, thinking about these issues and how we relate to animals. But one question I had, which was also brought up, was how do we try to sort of be non-anthropocentric explicitly in the social welfare function, but we are also sort of forced in a way to choose some parameter, such as sentience, in which to operationalize that in terms of experiencing welfare. But there are also other choices, which might be kin relationships, for instance, which we see in particular communities in relating to these groups. They could be relationships between different parts of an ecological system in a particular geographical area. And that might lead us to different policy decisions, bringing it back to the practical. And it will also lead to different purchase decisions. For instance, some species might be completely morally out of the scope of policy regulation because it's sacred. An example of this is sacred groves for particular communities. There might be particular sorts of food which is off the table because they're considered, you know, not in within a religious sort of moral framework. So in that sense, it's around those sorts of relationships rather than sentience, I think, which really might structure and influence human behavior, or even understanding a system rather than, say, sentience. So I was curious as to why sentience, and does the sort of more relational aspect bring us to a different policy conclusion, essentially? And how would you reconcile that?
Yeah, this is true that sentience, sentientism, is key in this approach. Why is that? Because I'm an economist, and as I said in the presentation, I consider that what matters at the end is welfare. And this is because I take this welfarist approach that we used to take in economics. We care only about welfare, the welfare of humans, but now we care about the welfare of animals. So I make this step. We extend, but we keep what we care about, which is welfare. So this is a bias. I'm following what we are doing in economics. We are maximizing welfare, essentially. So I'm just keep following this tradition, and I agree this can be questioned, because maybe there may be something else. But this is why, at the end of the day, I'm using this concept of sentience, because it's very extremely close to the concept of welfare. So that's the short answer.
And also, animals have no agency, but your method effectively gives them some agency. I mean, they don't actually make decisions, but at least, you know, that agency is given some weight. And I mean, in your area, in terms of philosophy, philosophers like Peter Singer and so on would argue that we have a responsibility to act as custodians for animals in the same way as we have a responsibility to act for custodians of the very young or the elderly, yeah, or people that can't do things for themselves. But, you know, the question I have is, are we taking that responsibility seriously? I would argue that in many cases we are, if it's our pets, for example. But when it comes to animals that we want to use for other benefits, agricultural animals, wild animals, you know, that custodianship is largely lacking, I would argue.
So once again, it's very related to the approach I develop in the book, which is the standard approach we use in economics about maximizing welfare. And so I don't really discuss other moral rules we may want to discuss. For instance, moral responsibility, deontological principles. I acknowledge that at the end, that this is a strong limitation. And once again, I'm following the tradition in economics, but I agree it's a limitation, and I hope that other people will pursue that road. And by the way, Jonathan, do you have any view about that? It's a deep question, I guess, that has been much discussed in philosophy. So sorry to...
Which question?
This idea that we may... this debate about welfare in animal ethics, for instance, between welfarism, the welfaristic, yeah, approach, and the deontological approach, idea that we have a moral responsibility toward animals.
Of course, these are huge questions, yeah. I mean, I think you're right to not take a stand on them in the book. That's what I think. That you think of the human case, you can have all kinds of disagreements about what human rights are and what the constraints are on welfare maximization. Nonetheless, it's really useful to have those economist people telling us what maximizes welfare so that we can then apply our side constraints. And in effect, I see that's what you're attempting to do in this book, is saying, yeah, sure, we can have that debate about whether there are side constraints in the animal case too, so whether there are fundamental rights that might constrain our interventions. Nonetheless, whether you think that's true or not, really useful to know what the welfare maximizing option would be under various assumptions about constraints. And to me, that's the distinctive role that economists like you are able to play here.
I think there's something, speaking to that, I think there's really important note about the context. You talked about context-dependent preferences. And I think particularly the analysis on farmed animals, this approach is so helpful, because what it does is sort of try to visualize and measure in very human intervention environments what it means to have a more welfarist approach. And that's much harder point to take than in another context where, for instance, human intervention is mediated in other ways. This is an industrial scale production process, and there's an explicit commodification of animals, and that's the relationship that we have with them, is maybe one way to think about it. And in those sorts of cases, I think there's both, and you mentioned this in the book, both an intrinsic worth of the animal life, but there's also an instrumental one. Yeah. And that's, I think, very apt for sort of a welfarist approach. So my point being, there might be different contexts in which this approach is extremely valuable and could be maybe supplemented. The boundary conditions might be slightly different in another case with a different community, where maybe those relationships with animals aren't necessarily as commodities.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously two views on the relevance of relations versus intrinsic properties. But yeah, there's this tradition in ethics that I suppose I'm somewhat associated with that says it's the intrinsic properties of the animal that matter. You know, the question is, does the pig feel, not how do we feel about the pig? Yeah. You know, fundamentally, moral status is grounded in the intrinsic capacities of the animal. I find that a very attractive view because I think relations come and go. You know, the way people think about pigs is incredibly different to how they think and feel about dogs. This varies cross-culturally to an enormous degree, varies across time to an enormous degree, but I don't think the moral status of pigs or dogs varies in that way. So I'm always on team intrinsic in that particular debate. Sounds like, Ganga, you're maybe more on team relational.
I think so, because I feel there are goods in the goods. There are entities, there are systems which might be quite complex, and within them concealed relationships which might have a huge and profound effect on, say, the stability of a particular ecological niche or sets of systems within it. So, for instance, a river is a good example. My own name, Ganga, is one which is supposed to be quite sacred, and there's lots of really interesting literature around it in terms of, on the one hand, perceptions of being sacred don't necessarily align with perceptions of whether the river was perceived as pure. There's some psychological research that suggests that people who believe it's sacred often misperceive pollution levels. They underestimate it. So it's not necessarily that because you perceive something as sacred, it is cleaner. On the flip side, we've got lots of experience and evidence from lots of communities across the world, including in India, which is in the same context, where people perceive groves as sacred and implicitly do a lot to conserve them as long as you've got that relationship with that space. And that essentially means trees, for instance, are considered of intrinsic worth, and that enables an entire ecosystem to flourish within the trees. There's not much evidence of, say, the quality of that ecosystem in terms of the quality of animal life and so on, but at least you've got a slightly more intact ecosystem. So it can go in different ways. So in that sense, I think I am slightly on the relational side. But when it comes to farming, I think it's a slightly more clear-cut case.
Yeah, you're sympathetic to, I suppose, traditional folk beliefs of various kinds that have a long track record of conserving ecosystems well. So you're a little bit sceptical of... I mean, economics itself as a discipline is quite tangled up with expansion of industry, including industrial methods of farming that have destroyed many of those ecosystems that past generations had successfully maintained. So does that type of issue worry you, Nicholas?
So, one, I thought about that, and I briefly discussed that at the beginning, but once again, keeping this welfaristic approach, it was very natural for me to adopt a sentientist approach. Talking now about the biocentric approach, or even an ecocentric approach, seems beyond what we can do to start thinking about this problem. It's already extremely difficult to think about the welfare of animals, and as we said before, to get that into policy making. I have completely no clue about how we can integrate the welfare of ecosystem or mushroom bacteria and so on, trees. Maybe it's in the future we will make progress on that, but at this point, I think it's just a natural starting point to take, at least from an economics point of view, to have this welfaristic approach and just focus on sentient animals.
Just one way might be if we think about values, so if we think about ecocentric values versus biospheric values versus, say social, altruistic or egoistic values, that's one way of conceptualizing this in the environmental psychology literature. That's a way of well-being entering the preference function. So that would correspond to an indirect approach, maybe.
Yes, true. It would be indirect, the terminology here.
Yeah, using your direct versus indirect, that could be one way that it would be, in a weird way, that's cutting the anthropocentric with the non-anthropocentric.
True. Yeah, so it will soon be time to turn to your questions. So please think of questions you'd like to ask Nicholas or any of our panelists. I was thinking about that example you had on the slide, Nicholas, of the animal welfare levy, where it's an illustration of how stark some of the conclusions and results in the book are. That I think it's very, very striking that you're showing that even given quite conservative assumptions about how much the welfare of a chicken matters. And I think there's some coefficient you use that is 0.00 something. Even that, because the numbers are so enormous. In the UK, for example, it's over 1 billion chickens farmed for meat every year. If you were to take their welfare seriously at all and think of the suffering of a chicken as something that has negative value in the social welfare function, it's just impossible to escape the conclusion that one should be whacking a gigantic animal welfare tax on this product. I mean, it's an extraordinary result. I mean, do you see any sort of realistic pathway through which that kind of result might result in change? Because I can see some people looking at it the other way and saying, well, that's, I suppose they might say it's a reductio ad absurdum of the approach, that, oh, look, it turns out when we give any consideration in the social welfare function to other animals, they're immediately swamping human interests because, chicken, most popular meat there is getting a tax so high that no one can afford it anymore. Some might argue that just shows the impossibility of including animals in this way. Do you see any merit in that?
Yes, it's a question about the implication of that for policy making. As you said, we use conservative numbers here, and despite that, we find a huge amount of taxes for animal welfare consideration on chicken and pigs.
It's like you open the door a tiny bit, and then suddenly, there's no stopping it.
But remember that at least using total utilitarianism as a social welfare function, we suggest there could be even subsidy for meat cows. And if we take organic chicken, for instance, the tax would be tiny. So one response could be that the tax is so high for chicken and pigs because their rearing conditions are very bad. If we change the rearing conditions, then we get into a very different level of taxes, much smaller ones, and even possibly some subsidies.
I think the analysis that you do, though, you do caveat those with saying, look, this is a sort of a rough first attempt at putting some numbers on this. But it does, as the reader, make you sit up and notice and say, wow, these are really big numbers. Maybe there is something that we're fundamentally not getting right here. And at the start of your book, you make this statement, which I think many of us can relate to, certainly as economists. When something isn't counted, it eventually doesn't count. And that has happened with animal welfare. We haven't had, a trusted method where we can take into account the suffering of animals. And so that suffering has tended to be put, swept under the carpet, if you like. And we've not paid due regard to it. So I think, however reliable or unreliable you may consider your estimates to be, it makes you think. And I think it should make policymakers and others and farmers and, I mean, it should make everyone think, wow, perhaps we really haven't got this right.
Yeah. On that, I was also wondering, it's sort of the mode of food, the mode of production, right? So, for instance, open field, like grass-fed beef has a little subsidy, whereas the industrial agriculture has a massive penalty in terms of a levy. So in some cases, it might just be scaling back those sectors, and that will face huge political resistance. So I was wondering if there's been political resistance to your work when you've...
There has not been really political resistance to this recent work with the book, but I am in France, I am at INRA. It's a research institute associated with agriculture. And of course, it's a touchy topic. I can see that not all colleagues are very happy with that. Of course, when you work with animals for the industry, you may not be happy to hear that you are doing a morally problematic activity, and this is what I write in the book. So, I got some resistance, but overall, I'm very free to do the research I want to do, and I'm at TU School of Economics. We are very well protected from different interests. So I was lucky enough to not to be too much influenced by the industry to some extent. And I'm not in an agricultural economics department, so it's at TU School of Economics, so this is something to mention. So the funding does not depend on this agricultural interest.
And of course, as soon as things get real, the industry does oppose change very vigorously. We've seen this recently with the so-called Better Chicken Commitment, where many companies signed up to it. There's a commitment to switch to slower growing breeds of chicken so that they don't have these terrible leg problems and lameness and so on that comes from growing explosively fast. And we've seen in recent weeks multiple companies backing out of this commitment. Richard, this must be on your mind. Getting real change done with these industries is often very hard, because it's like the closer you get to producing a shift, the more aggressively they push back.
Mm. Yeah, it is a real challenge, of course, but and you do have to give industry time to adjust. You know, you can't, obviously it's completely unfair just to say this is no longer acceptable, stop doing it now, do it all differently. But I think the political imperative is lacking, and perhaps for obvious reasons given everything that's going on in the world at the moment. You know, animal welfare is always going to be one of those things that tends to get, you know,
it's knocked down the agenda,
put onto the back burner, as it were. But I think, you know, this method of including animals into the, you know, a multi-species social welfare function actually would help to protect against that to some degree.
Great. Okay, it'd be wonderful to take some questions from the audience at this point. So please wait for the microphone to come to you so that we can all hear your question. Can we start from four rows from the back there? Please wait for the microphone to come to you. Thanks for your patience.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk. It's very interesting. I'm a little bit confused how we can both say that animals have intrinsic welfare and still consider killing them because we find them yummy. But I think what I struggle with a little bit is that if we create this sort of welfare scale for animals, but our case study of animals are animals that are being dominated, that are being tortured, that are being murdered, that skews the scale, right? Like if our only case study for a human welfare scale were humans who are being enslaved, you know, tortured, killed, that's going to create a very skewed scale. So apart from the fact that it's very hard for us to know what animal welfare really looks like, because it's clearly not the same as human welfare necessarily, how can we possibly do that from what it is that we're seeing in the world, where there are really not many animals who are free, if any, and so could show us what their welfare actually looks like?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, it's a challenging one, and I'm going just to partly answer, and I'm happy if my colleagues, if they want, may want to complement my answer. So in one of the models that I develop in the book that gives rise to these animal welfare levies that I've presented, indeed, at the beginning, I make an assumption. I assume that animals live because we eat them. This is the assumption I'm making. So farmed animals live because we eat them. And this is close to the truth, the way the economy functions. We create, in France, for instance, every year, we kill 1 billion of animals, so 3 million every day, and we raise and slaughter all these animals because we are going to eat them. So I think this is a fairly natural assumption, but where I think I would tend to agree with what you suggest, if I understood it well, is that still it remains an assumption, because we may think about a different world where animals live and they don't live because we eat them. And this is not part of a model. We could think about, even using that approach, we can think about a different question, research question, which will be, and that will be very challenging. Suppose we care about welfare in this world, the welfare of all animals. What's the optimal distribution of species on Earth, if we suppose we can have control about that, okay? And potentially we will end up with answers such as we may want many of these species and maybe not so many humans and so on. And this is
which is crazy, but this is a different world. And I'm not going to that direction in the book. I'm starting with something which is, I guess, close to what we, the world, the way it is now, with markets for meat and farmed animal. But I understand that this is this may be viewed as a bit problematic.
Okay, let's have a question in the second row now.
Hi, thanks for the talk. Really interesting, and probably, I think, on the basis of that, going to pick up a copy of the book. So that part of the job done. I was conscious, just until just a few moments ago, I don't think I really heard the word slaughter or death mentioned in your talk. And I was wondering where the process of dying, or actually being killed, actually fits in, if at all, and if there's any attempts to think about the economics of slaughter, and particularly the fact that within the industrialized food system, animals are slaughtered at a very young age relative to what you know, a reasonable estimate of natural lifespan. So is there any attempt to think about, well, what is the harm that we do to an animal when slaughtering it at a very young age? Is there any sense of that has a cost in terms of depriving an animal of a certain amount of life, of a certain quality? Anything along those lines in the framework?
Don't hesitate to jump in. Huh?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, in a way,
but, okay.
Yeah.
But so you're right, it's a good question, because death is part of a book, but I didn't use that word, and I should have, maybe, in the presentation, and it's part of a way when I evaluate animal welfare, animal suffering, I'm making assumptions about the quality of life, and that includes the last day of life and how painful is the slaughter process. So this is there. But there are two limitations there. One aspect is that the way we compute welfare is a sum of welfare you get every day. And maybe we don't account in a very accurate way all this massive suffering that animals experience in the very last day. And it's difficult to really weight this one day of one hour or minute of massive suffering compared to a life maybe of 6 months that has a pig or 40 days chicken. So that's one limitation, and we may adjust that maybe, and I'm not sure we have done a good job by just making this assumption that total welfare is just the sum of everyday experience. And maybe the process of death is not well accounting. And the other aspect is the fact that indeed, when we kill a chicken after 40 days, which is the norm, or a pig after 6 months, or a dairy cow after 6 years, it's just a part of their life expectancy. And so there is a cost here. A cost which is the fact that they are not going to experience welfare in the future. And this is something that is not well addressed here. We assume that the date of slaughter is fixed. But nevertheless, I discuss that in some part of the books, and in particular, there is a very interesting argument that you probably know, which is the replaceability argument by Peter Singer, which is considered as a repugnant argument, but still it's very difficult to refute it, which is the fact that if you kill an animal after 40 days, the problem is that you are going to bring another animal to life. And in a sense, the loss of welfare that you create, that you generate by killing an animal, could somehow be compensated, and this is the claim, by the birth of another animal who is going to live because you have killed the first animal. And this is, conceptually, this is very troubling.
But then this aspect, I guess, is not standard in mainstream human economics. Right? When we're thinking about humans, it's quite a familiar idea that if you deprive a human of life, you've deprive them of a lot of quality-adjusted life years they might have otherwise enjoyed. I mean, if we were to take that into account in the animal case, you know, farming is going to come out even worse, potentially much worse. In a way, what I find quite striking about your results, Nicholas, is that even when you make a bunch of assumptions that one might consider broadly pro-farming, including the ones you've just been describing, still certain kinds of farming end up with these gigantic animal welfare levies. That's, if you think of it in that way, just how I'm thinking about it, it's quite striking that those conservative assumptions lead to that result.
Yeah.
Right. It's interesting that a lot of veterinarians would say that death is not a welfare issue. It's the humaneness of that, it's the way of dying, the humaneness of dying. So there's, I mean, effectively there are two potential costs, aren't there? One is the suffering of the animal because of the slaughter process, and the other is this you know, opportunity cost in relation to the utility lost. Personally, I have trouble with the utility lost argument myself. But then on the other hand, I can see it from a human perspective, as you say, I can see that. But I have more difficulty seeing it from the animal perspective. Yeah. But even with animals, there is a cost to others. There's a cost to the mother if it's a calf or whatever that's lost and so on. So it is quite complicated, actually, isn't it? And there isn't parity between humans and animals.
Certainly, I would love to see more debate among vets about these kinds of things and among animal welfare experts, because I think it's very contestable, really. That in our own case, we see very clearly that death is a welfare harm because we're deprived of future life. And we sometimes perhaps jump too readily to the idea that it's not for other animals as well.
I mean, I look at extinction, and that's a very different take on this issue, in the sense of when we think about extinction, it's the permanent loss of a particular strand of life, a particular species of life. And I think that's something else which we don't really have a welfare take on, actually. When we think of extinction, we think about, would you not want some, one way economists think about this is a bequest value, so you haven't left the species on Earth for future generations to enjoy. It's a question of legacy. Others think about it in terms of an ecosystem, a niche which is broken. But in terms of welfare, it's quite difficult to think of extinction because it's almost final. But I think it relates very much to this demand question that you've raised, which is we do see that when animals which we've traditionally used for industry have not been used, I'm thinking about things like the cart horse or greyhound racing or horses, they do tend to have lower numbers. So they might have higher welfare and well-being, but lower numbers. And that's what we're also seeing in wild is a contested term, but in wilder spaces, where we've seen a huge defaunation of animal and bird species because, you know.
Yeah, let's see how many questions we can get in. Here's a question from the online audience. How practical is the framework in other countries, low and middle income countries especially, who struggle majorly with human welfare, let alone adding animal welfare into the mix? You say in the book, don't you, that it is mainly pretty rich countries you have in mind in developing this framework?
Yes, at the end of the book, I list what the topics that I have overlooked and that require further research, and this is one of the topics.
Yeah, okay, and so there's a question from here, five rows from the front. Please wait for the microphone. Thank you.
Hi there, Jamie Woodhouse from Sentientism. To pick up a couple of the themes that have been covered in the questions already, I think it's really important to frame animal economics as a distinct intervention, because non-human animals have been almost completely neglected in economics. But by framing animal economics as a separate topic within economics, there is a risk that the anthropocentrism creeps back in some of the ways we've been discussing here. Could you imagine animal economics, rather than being seen as a separate discipline with economics, end up being integrated into a fully sentientist economics? So we maybe even end up giving human animals a multiplier based on our forebrain neurons and building it into a coherent, integrated model.
It's interesting because it's about the strategy within my own discipline, and I've never really thought about this aspect of your question. It's interesting. So my objective here was to propose, as you understood, an approach that is in line with what we do in economics, staying closer, welfaristic, behavioral economics, building on previous work in agricultural economics. But indeed, at some point, there are some discontinuities. And it's difficult for me to evaluate how much these discontinuities will impact the development of this field. I don't know, do you have any view about that?
It's a worrying way of thinking, isn't it? Because potentially you could have different types of people in society that have a different weight, because some suffer more than can suffer more than others, or yeah. I don't
Which
know.
Sounds
I
mean, like a pretty bad idea.
You know, if you're doing it on the basis of, you know, mental functioning and neurons and so on, you know, you guys are probably in quite a good position, you know, at the LSE here with your, you know, your brain functions and everything. But you know, the rest of us are maybe not in such a good condition. But all joking apart, that's a worrying concept, isn't it? That people have different welfare weights because their supposed ability to suffer is quantified as being different.
Doesn't this also go back to objections to some of Singer's arguments in terms of people who have different abilities, but also younger children who need care and so on? How does that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in the human case, a lot of Peter Singer's views are very controversial, precisely because he really denies the idea of inalienable rights that nothing could override.
Yeah.
Many people, when they think about the human case, they really strongly feel there are such rights. Yeah. At least that debate we were having earlier about whether we should say exactly the same thing about the non-human animal case. There is one of the online questions here that is about how did Nicholas come to decide on using the number of neurons, or specifically the number of forebrain neurons, as a measure of sentience and welfare. I think that is indeed one of the most controversial assumptions in the book.
You probably don't like that, but you can speak after. But it's a working hypothesis. What we want is a conversion rate. So we want to be able to compare the welfare of different species. And once again, we are focused on welfare. We want a measure of a capacity for welfare. And there is some research showing that there is a correlation between cognitive ability, emotions, and the number of neurons, in particular forebrain neurons, so these neurons that are in this sensory part of the brain. And the good thing with that is we have these figures. We have data about the number of neurons of many species. So this is a number which is at our disposal and that we can update. If it turns out that we want to modify it, for instance, by accounting the firing rate of neurons or other properties of the brain, we can adjust. But it is a very strong assumption, and this is one of the assumptions that has been most criticized.
Yeah, I mean, in a way I would criticize it, but I've also been explaining how I'm thinking about this, the whole project in the book really, is even when you grant a bunch of assumptions that is actually, in a way, very pro-human, very pro-farming. In fact, assumptions that are so pro-farming, one might say, that the beef farming comes out with receiving a positive animal welfare bonus. Even when you have that set of assumptions, look at the chickens, look at the pigs, you know, there's no reasonable set of assumptions anyone could come up with that would justify what those industries are doing. And that's extremely striking to me. So even though, of course, that set of assumptions is not a set of assumptions I agree with, the fact that it leads to those results is, I think, very important. So we've got time for one more question. Let's have a question from the front row here. And then I think we'll be out of time. The front row.
So in recent years, I noticed that there's like an increase in lab-grown meats and stuff like that. So I wanted to ask you, how do you feel about that being integrated into the market for consumption economically, in regards to economically?
So I missed
lab-grown meat.
Lab-grown meat.
Cultivated meat?
Yes.
Yes, I speak about cultivated meat at the end of the book. It's a very good question because I emphasize in the book, in particular in the beginning, that innovations that can really reduce our dependency to animals. If we look in the past, we replace horse carriage by cars, we use tractors,
We use synthetic clothing, so we reduce our dependency from animals. And very, very often the lobbying forces are so strong, and Marion, probably you're an expert on that, so I don't hesitate to jump in, but that sometimes the only way we can really move forward is through innovation. And innovation, we know in economics, and the last Nobel Prize in economics is about innovation, we know that it's central to explain economic development, to explain growth. And through innovation, there is a lot of hope. And cultivated meat is really a big hope in the sense that we can keep the taste, we can keep the habits, all what we like, without the suffering. So there is a big hope. But the problem, there are several problems, but the main problem is that it's not, at this point, it's not cost effective. And it's not clear that it will be one day cost effective. So we'll see.
But your approach presumably would justify government subsidies to those kinds of industries.
Of course, yeah.
So that's all we've got time for. If you'd like to buy a copy of the book, and I'd encourage that, please go out to the desk outside in the foyer. And thanks very much to everyone who asked questions, and thanks to the online audience too. And thanks to Nicola.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.